Hi, everyone. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're seeing in terms of the judicial landscape and legal landscape. And I'm looking at it more of a taking a theoretical approach to it, because oftentimes, you know, we try and get right into the nitty-gritty, and I am, in fact, a law student, and, you know, I think that oftentimes a lot of common sense and gut feelings can go into how you feel about what is happening, and you don't necessarily have to be thinking in a matter of, you know, this is the law and this is how it should be. So that's kind of the approach I'm taking, so I hope you like it. Courts and the law are facing a generational gap. That's what we've been talking about a lot today. And, for example, the principal judge of the New Zealand Youth Court said, one thing about being a youth court judge is that things never stand still. This is a qualitatively new challenge for my generation involved in youth justice. We must be trained to deal with the issues. We must do it. It is a non-negotiable part of our ongoing training. So he's acknowledging that we're facing situations that are novel, and there are questions as to whether or not we should be using our regular legal framework or whether we should be developing new laws that are taking into account these new situations. Generations are growing up digital. That's really at the core of what he's saying. We've been flooded with information and learning to access, sort, categorize, and remember it all has enhanced these children's intelligence. You know, my brother, who's 15 now, is even further removed from technology than my cousin, who's 6. She was showing him how to fix a problem on his iPad recently. So, I mean, this is really a very, very new area that we're trekking into, and we really need to understand that, you know, these exceptional technological abilities that these kids are displaying doesn't necessarily mean that they possess exceptional moral and discerning capacity. You know, we see these kids growing up and we see how they interact with technology, but at the same time, for example, as Professor Talwar was telling you before, there is a certain, you know, there's a way that we develop morally, and there are questions as to whether or not our moral capacity and ability to discern between right and wrong actually does catch up with our ability to use technology. And so there's often a gap in that sense as well between age and the law. And we're seeing this manifest itself in harsh sentencing or harsh application of the law, as I think Professor Van Prague was saying. You know, the law is a bully, it's inflexible. And we're also seeing it in, you know, how can I do something? How can I just, you know, try and make this work, almost in an act of desperation? And this was a perfect example. Dr. Sharif was talking about it earlier, where a 16-year-old girl was drugged and gang-raped at a rave. The video of the rape was posted on Facebook. It went viral. Police announced that anyone that had this footage was going to be charged with possessing child pornography. And the adolescent who posted the video on Facebook was not actually one of the rapists, but he gave it to a friend to post up. And once he got to his hearing, he showed remorse, and that's not to be cynical. It's obviously very possible that there was, you know, remorse, and the judge had deemed that he had matured, and so there was 1 year probation and ordered a written essay about the evils of the internet. This is not to say necessarily that we need harsher sentencing, but I think that writing an essay about the evils of the internet, it's kind of like when, you know, you watch the Reefer Madness movies. It seems very out of touch, and it places a lot of culpability on the technology and not necessarily a lot of liability on the person who's actually, you know, committing the act and posting the video itself. So that's something that we found very interesting, and we find that kind of shows one disconnect. And then, as you've all heard the countless times today, the AB versus Bragg Communications case, where there was a fake Facebook profile that was created with scandalous. I'm pretty sure there was photos as well, but essentially it was putting this girl in a light that was very sexy and distasteful. And what ended up happening was this large constitutional case where there was a question whether she could proceed through the courts anonymously, you know, and whether there could be a publication ban. And the lower courts didn't strike an appropriate balance between AV's privacy and freedom of the press. Essentially, as was discussed before, in order for publication bans to be allowed, they do a test. It's called the Dajin and Mentuk test. And one of the factors of that test is that you have to show that it's necessary to prevent a serious risk to proper administration of justice. This is just one of the two factors that's necessary to pass this test and order a publication ban. And this notion of serious risk has been deemed, I think it was Justice Iacobucci, who said that it has to be real, substantial, and grounded in evidence. And what ended up happening was they said, we have no tangible evidence that this is going to actually create a serious risk to you. And so we have Justice Saunders who said, for example, subjective feelings of discomfort cannot be the test for anonymity. The mere fact of AB's age did not establish any kind of special vulnerability such that the court ought to intervene and place her interests above the constitutional rights of others, which I think Professor Bailey would agree misses the point. It's out of touch. It's illogical. And that's why it's really important that it did get appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. And what they discussed was that while evidence of a direct and harmful consequence to an individual applicant is relevant, courts need to conclude that there is objectively discernible harm. It's logical to infer that cyberbullying creates psychological toxicity. So there's an out of here, for example, we see that the law was being applied very harshly, and then we see kind of a let it go a little. You know, we recognize now there's a lot of social evidence, a lot of psychological evidence that shows that these types of that cyberbullying can cause serious harm. And for us at Define the Line, we like to look at it through Ryan M. Callow's framework, which looks at subjective versus objective privacy harm. So subjective privacy harm is unwanted perception of observation, and objective is the unanticipated or coerced use of information concerning a person against that person. And so here it's interesting, we say to look at cyberbullying and the creation of Facebook pages, sexting, unwanted posts or photographs on social media through Callow's framework, because the impact of emotional distress and fear that might occur when teenagers first have their information used against them through the creation of false Facebook pages, for example, and even if the page is taken down, the subjective privacy harm that may come from their concern that they may be watched and harmed if people know their identity. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about objectively discernible harm, that not only was AB being said horrible things about on the Facebook page, the false Facebook page that was made of her, but also that once she would have to proceed through court and without a pseudonym and also with a lack of a publication ban, that she would have to relive it over and over again and that the world's eyes would just be on her. And that's not something that we want to be putting vulnerable youth through. And just importantly, that the judicial and legal gap essentially were, you know, we've, in terms of defamation, for example, normally, I mean, if you can conceptualize a defamation case, you're clearing your good name, right? I mean, you're, someone said something about you and you want to set the record straight. That, it seems, you know, completely out of touch with what we're looking at with vulnerable children, right? They want to proceed through court anonymously. They don't want it going out there. They just want the page down. So it's really just an interesting kind of anomaly that we're seeing here that's being created by technology and trying to apply existing laws to the use of said technology and cyberbullying. So just some assumptions that we've kind of discussed, the internet's culpability, so the role of technology, These are all, by the way, things for you to kind of ponder. I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, ISPs shouldn't have liability and things like that, but I do think that, you know, there is something to say for, yes, holding, you know, kids responsible, especially at a certain age. Psychological harm versus physical harm. We talked about, you know, subjective versus objective. The importance of the media. So obviously freedom of the press is a very important pillar, you know, for us and as it should be. But at the same time, I think that Dr. Sharif discussed that oftentimes there's media sensationalism and that creates a lot of issues, not just for the victim, but also for trolls, cappers, et cetera, and also, you know, students or other teens who are going through the same thing. And whether or not the current legal framework that we're using is suitable to apply to novel situations. So thank you, and I'm passing it off to Nima.